Yeah, I'm like Charlie. I had a lot of people I didn't want to make amends to also, and I didn't know how to go about making amends to those people that I didn't want to make amends to. As a matter of fact, I was so mad at those people and felt that they'd hurt me so bad that they owed me amends that I wouldn't make amends to anybody. So the little formula was real simple, and most things in AA is simple. He said, we take the list and look it over, and there's some people on that list that you would like to make amends to, and you'd probably make it to them right now if you could, wouldn't you? I said, yeah.
That's maybe our children or our brother or our sister or mother. Our father or so on and so forth.
Really
people
easy.
We'd really like to get straightened out with.
Oh, what's her name? I put her aside for a while. So we take all, let's look down the list of the names and take all those people on that list that we can make amends to right now and put them on a now list. And then you go about and set the rest of them aside. You go about and so you start making amends to those as you can do right now. And once we get those completed, then we can go down to those people who we're willing to make amends to, but maybe not right now, maybe a little bit later. So we take the list and go down the list and pull all those people down there that we can make amends to a little bit later and put them on the list. Talk with my sponsor about how I can go about making amends to those people a little bit later and then start making those amends a little later. And when we get completed with that, there's some other people on that list still left, those that maybe I'll make amends to and maybe I won't. So I'll look down my list of names I've got left over and let's find the maybes in there and leave the nevers on the side. And I looked at the maybes and put them down, and by now I'm getting some experience. I'm getting some good feedback. I'm beginning to feel good. You see, and I see the value of making amends. And those people that I maybe make to, I start looking for them to make. Maybe I will make amends to them. Some of those people will put into my life. The wherever possible, wherever is made possible by God, I believe. And I begin to make those maybe list. Now those nevers, boy, those nevers are really tough. And so I take the rest of the names off of that list and put them on a list for never going to make amends to them. Except I become willing to the list as time went by and begin to see the value of making these amends. And those nevers begin to crop up. Some of them I went out looking for them to make amends. You know, step nine is a definite three-part step. It tells us when to do it, when what to do, what kind of amends to make, direct amends to wherever possible, and when not to do it. You see, a three-part step, and I can do that. And this little list and little formula helped me. So I wrote down again the now list, the later list, the maybe list, and the nevers list. As I said here today, all of those people have been made amends to in one way or another. And I'm free of all that stuff, which is what I wanted to be anyhow, you see. And I'm very free.
That's one of the ways we can become willing to make amends to them all, by actually making the four lists and then work our way through the list. My sponsor told me, he said, I believe if you'll start on these right nows, by the time you're through, you'll be ready for those laters. And if you'll do the laters, you'll probably get ready for the maybes. And he said, I'm going to bet you a $20 bill right now that by the time you're through with the maybes, you'll be ready to start on the nevers. And you know, the old fool was right. He didn't let me use three or four names to block myself entirely off from this process. He gave me a way to become willing to make amends to them all. Worked great for me. I've used it on several people since then. It works real good.
We worked with this 2 months ago, and I just dawned on me what happens with this little list. You know, you do nows. When you finish the nows, the maybes become the nows. The laters become the nows. When you do the laters, then the maybes become the nows. And you get all that done, the nevers become the nows, and you get through. Mm-hmm. You're always doing the nows.
Step nine.
It said, probably there are some misgivings as we look over the list of business acquaintances and friends we have hurt. We may feel different about going to some of them on a spiritual basis. Let us be reassured. And some we need not promise should not emphasize the spiritual features of our first approach. we might prejudice them. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. What we're trying to do, the third dimension of life. We ain't got our lives in order yet. We're going to the last dimension. But this is not the end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves in the maximum service to God and the people about us. Still working in an area. Okay, now he talks about, first thing he tells us in step 9 is make direct amends. And we look at direct amends as two types of direct amends. The first one is mentioned here in the book in the next paragraph, down in the middle of the paragraph, some reason why he started this new paragraph, but he never did. It should be a new paragraph, but this is the way he did it.
One kind of direct amend.
Yeah.
Is eyeball to eyeball.
Face to face.
Face to face. One on one. Now, I know the book says a little later on we can write a letter if we need to. We could even make a telephone call if we need to. But I'm trying to get rid of all my fear, my guilt, and my remorse associated with these things from the past. If I write you a letter, I'm never quite sure how you received it. I'm still concerned about what you're going to say or you're going to do the next time I run into you. If I call you on the telephone, I got the same situation. But if I go to you and sit down and talk with you eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one, when I'm through, you will have done the worst you're going to do to me right there. I'll never have to be worried about what you're going to say or do when I run into you again. I will know that I have done my utmost. Eyeball to eyeball, face to face, one on one, direct amend.
The question of how we approach the man we hated will arise. It may be he has done more harm than we have done him, and though we have acquired a better attitude toward him, we're still not too keen about admitting our mistakes. Nevertheless, with a person we didn't like, we take the bit in the teeth. It's harder to go to the enemy than to a friend, but we find it much more beneficial to us. We go to him in a help-forgiving spirit, confessing our ill feelings and expressing our regret. Under no condition do we criticize such a person or argue. Simply, we tell him we have never get over our record until we have done our utmost to straighten out the past. We are there. We want to see this man face to face, to sleep off our side of the street, realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so. Never trying to discuss, tell him what he should do. We are false and not discussed. We stick to our own. If our manner is calm, frank, open, we are gratified with the results. In 9 cases out of 10, the unexpected happens. Sometimes a man we are calling upon admits his own mistakes. So feuds of years standing melt away in an hour. Rarely do we fail to make satisfactory progress. Our former enemies sometimes praise what we are doing and wish us well. Occasionally they will offer assistance. It should not matter, however, if someone does throw us out of his office. We have made our demonstration, done our part, as water over the dam. And it's just it's an example of going to a person's office, sitting down face to face, making a direct amend to him.
Eyeball to eyeball, face to face. Joe's gotten one of those kind of amends in his past life that I think fits this just exactly with his cousin. Joe, you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I was in the area of making amends, and one morning I was at a restaurant having breakfast, and I looked up and there was my cousin Gary. This little story always reminds me of Gary because we were just exactly alike. Gary and I couldn't get around each other without verbally abusing each other, and a lot of times we would physically abuse each other and get into a fight. But I looked up and Gary was standing at the door, and I said, "Well, is this odd or is this God? I mean, I don't know." But wherever possible. And I motioned Gary over, and he came over and asked him to sit down. And he sat down reluctantly because he wasn't quite sure what I might do. And finally he sat down, and I said, "Gary, I've joined Alcoholics Anonymous, and I need to clean away the wreckage of the past if I can and make amends for the people I've harmed. And I've harmed you a lot over the years. Would you forgive me?" He's kind of relaxed like that, and he said, "You know, Joe, I wish you'd forgive me for the things I've done to you." So all that stuff just went away just like that. Now, the best part of that story is that from time to time, Gary comes to Alcoholics Anonymous. Not often, but from time to time. And when he does come, he comes to the group that I attend, and we sit down and we'll visit as much as he'll allow me to about the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That would have never happened had that not happened a long time ago. I had another amend. We were talking yesterday, some guys out there, about making amends. And about 10 years ago, the president of our company caused me to give back a good-sized commission. It was a new rule. It happened one day. It was about $10,000. And really made me upset. I mean, I was really upset. He threatened me, you see. So I called him everything in the world that you could call a man in front of his secretary, our bookkeeper, and two other salesmen. This was on Friday. Boy, I was hot. And I left there, stormed out of there, and all weekend long I did the same thing I used to do. I lay awake nights and all day thinking about what I was going to do to that guy. See? Finally, it dawned on me late Sunday night, what you got to do is make amends. And how do you make amends for that? Well, I went back on Monday morning, and I called his secretary and their bookkeeper and those two salesmen into his office, and I told him, I said, Jim, I'm sorry that I got angry and said all those things. Would you forgive me? See, I created the crime before these people, and I figured I ought to make amends before them because the president of our company deserves a certain amount of respect. I didn't say I was wrong. I said I was sorry I got angry. And I wasn't wrong, but I paid the money back anyhow. But the point is, I'm sorry that I got angry and said those things before these people. And I asked him to forgive me, and you know what? Worked just like a charm. Went away. Went ahead and paid the money back, and it was okay.
He didn't tell you all the story. A few years later, he became the president of that company. Sure as hell did.
That's, okay, that's another story.
Another kind of direct amend is in equal restitution. Now, some of we alcoholics, when we were drinking, we tended to borrow money we never did pay back. We tended to run up bills we never did pick up. We tended to write checks we never did take care of. We tended to tear up automobiles that we never did fix. We've hurt a lot of people in the financial area, in the economic area, just as bad as we've ever hurt them in any other way. Now, what are we going to do about that to get rid of that fear and that guilt and that remorse? Bill handles that situation in the very next paragraph.
Most alcoholics owe money.
That's probably the understatement of the year right there.
We do not dodge our creditors, tell them what we are trying to do. We make no bones about our drinking. They usually know it anyway, whether we think so or not. Now, are we afraid to disclose that alcoholism on theory it may cause financial harm? Approached in this way, the most ruthless creditors sometimes surprise us, arrange the best deal we can. We let these people know we are sorry. Our drinking has made us slow to pay. We must lose our fears of creditors no matter how far we have to go while we're liable to drink if we underface them. Now, we can go to these people. We might not be able to pay them the way alcoholic likes to do with his ego. He would like to wait until he gets all the money and walk in there and say, here's your damn money. Put it in a big sack. But chances are we're not going to be able to do it that way. See, if we wait till we get out, we have to hide it from 5 years until we get all of his money. Drive ourselves crazy going through all that suffering. But we can go to that person and make arrangements, and we can agree to say, well, I don't have all your money, but I can pay you $10 or $20 a week until I pay you your money. And we can begin to pay on that. We got a small starting area. You know, I think it's real great. You know, we could take $10 and get the guy out of our head. We haven't got it off, but, you know, the fear is gone. The guilt and remorse is gone as soon as we start making amends.
We get one of them paid off. We go to the next one. And we say, you and I both know I owe you a couple thousand dollars. Can't pay you today. Sorry, I can. I wish I could. But I'd like to pay you $15, $20 a week, whatever I think I can live with. And you'd be glad to have $15 and $20 a week. That's a lot better than nothing. And I pay you that $15 or $20 a week. And some morning I wake up and I say, hey, that sucker's paid off too. The fear, the guilt, remorse is gone. Then I go to the next one. And then I go to the next one, I go to the next one, and I go to the next one. And someday I wake up and I say, you know, I've paid every one of them back, period. No fear, no guilt, no remorse. I feel pretty good about myself when we do that. Now, again, I hear people say, and I can hear awful good, I hear people say, Charlie, that's probably right for $1,000 or $2,000. But how about $50,000? How about $100,000? How about $500,000? How about $1,000,000? Could we pay that back? Well, I don't see why we can't. If we're smart enough to steal it, we're probably smart enough to pay it back.
Yeah. Sure.
I think we forget from step three on, God is with us. And if we are to do these things, God's going to make it possible for us to do so. The main thing is for us to be willing to do that and start taking the effort to get it done. And eventually, we get them all paid back and we're completely free of that. Joe and I had an old friend who used to live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, named Dan. Dan's dead now. But he would have been sober, what, Joe?
46.
46 this year if he had lived a little bit longer. When Dan, I'd been around for a few years, and Dan walked up to me one day and he said, Charlie, I paid the last one of them last week. I said, Dan, how long have you been paying them? He said, I've been sober 29 years. And it took me all that time to pay them back, but I finally got it done. I said, well, how do you feel, Dan? He said, I feel about 8 foot tall. Dan was a little bitty guy, about 5'1". He said, this is the first time in my life that I can ever remember that I don't owe somebody something for what I've stolen in the past. And he said, I feel pretty good about old Dan. Took him 29 years to pay him, but he did it. When Dan was drinking, he was in the oil business down in Texas. And he hooked him, and he hooked him big, too. And it took him a long time to pay him back. But he finally got it done. Tell you how good a con artist Dan was. His wife, Sarah, who later turned out to be a beautiful, beautiful Al-Anon lady, one time while Dan was drinking, she took him to the state insane asylum in Big Spring, Texas, to have him committed for alcoholic insanity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the head psychiatrist interviewed Sarah first, then he interviewed Dan. And after a while, Dan left and Sarah was locked up.
I don't think she ever forgave him for that.
She never did forgive him for that particular one.
She learned to live better electrically while she was there.
Now, we can do these things. We can do these things provided we're willing to do so. You know, God's going to help us, and it's going to make us possible.
Dan and Sarah spent an awful lot of time with Phyllis and I, because my wife's in Alcoholics Anonymous too now, thank God. She's sober 25 years and June 26th. And but long back, way back, but they spent an awful lot of time with us, teaching us, spoon-feeding us Alcoholics Anonymous while we were playing bridge. Taught us how to play bridge, how to stay in the same room without fighting. And taught us about AA, and Dan lived good. He put off a lot of money paying these people back, but Dan lived pretty dang good. Mm-hmm. It didn't cost him anything. He earned the money and was able to earn enough money to pay them back and still live good, which is a fear of some of us.
So our book tells us and our step tells us that we make these direct amends wherever possible. It also tells us when not to make them. except when to do so would injure them or others. And most of the rest of step 9 is not only dealing with how to make amends, but most of it also deals with where other people are affected. We've got to be real careful in this area. Because if we start making amends at the wrong time, the wrong way, in the wrong place, we're probably going to end up hurting some more people. Or just as importantly, we may hurt the one that we owe the amends to even worse yet. And if we do that, then later on we're going to have to come right back, start trying to make these amends and get rid of that fear and that guilt and that remorse. Bottom of page 78 talks about criminal offenses.
Perhaps we have committed a criminal offense which may land us in jail if we were known to the authorities. We may be short in our accounts and unable to make good. We have already admitted this to in the confidence of another person, but we are sure we would be in prison or lose our job if it were known. Maybe it's only a petty offense, such as padding the expense account. Most of us have done that sort of thing. Maybe we are divorced and have remarried now and haven't kept up with the alimony, number one. She is indignant about it and has a warrant now for our arrest. That's a common form of trouble, too. You know, we still have these things. It's a little different now. We have child support, not so much alimony, but child support. All these reparations take a numerous form. There are some general principles which we find guiding, reminding ourselves we have decided to go to any length to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given the strength and direction to do the right thing. No matter what the personal consequences may be, we may lose our position, our reputation, or face jail. But we are willing. We have to be. We must not shrink in anything.
Some more prayer there, too.
More prayer. We ask to be given the strength and directions.
Now the book warns us. It says, usually, however, other people are involved. Mm-hmm. Therefore, we are not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would needlessly sacrifice others to save himself from the alcoholic pit. We know a man who had remarried. Because of resentment and drinking, he had not paid alimony to his first wife. She was furious. She went to court and got an order for his arrest. He had commenced our way of life, had secured a position, was getting his head above water. It would have been impressive heroics if he had walked up to the judge and said, "Here I am." We thought he ought to be willing to do that if necessary. But if he were in jail, he could provide nothing for either family. We suggested he write his first wife, admitting his faults and asking forgiveness. He did, and also sent a small amount of money. He told her he would try to do it in the future. He said he was perfectly willing to go to jail if she insisted. Of course she did not, and the whole situation has long since been adjusted. We don't have so much of the alimony thing anymore because of the different kinds of divorces and et cetera that we experience today. But I see one great problem in AA and throughout the whole country as far as that's concerned, and this is this child support thing. We have one of these divorces, there's children involved, and one of the two is going to be ordered to pay some child support to the other, whether it be the mother or the father, depending on the circumstances. And if we don't end up paying that child support, we're probably going to be in just as much trouble as we would have been by not paying alimony. You know, I had a guy that had a couple young boys. I was sponsoring him. He came to me one day and he said, "You know, I'm not paying that bitch any more damn money." And I said, "Well, why not?" He said, "Because she's using my child support money to buy her stuff and do her thing. And it's really not going to the kids." He said, "I'm not going to pay her any more money." I said, "Well, what did the court order say?" And he said, "The court order says that I have to pay X number of dollars per kid each month. But I'm not going to pay it anymore." He said, "What would you do?" I said, "Well, looking at it from the outside view, I would suggest you pay your child support. Whatever she does with the money is beside the point. Because if you don't, and she goes to court, you're going to jail. By God, I'll not pay her another damn dime." I said, "Great, fine. If that's the way you want to do it, that's okay with me. It's not my business." 60, 70, 80, 90 days later, I don't know when, He called me one night. And I said, "Where are you?" And he said, "I'm in jail." I said, "You're in jail? What for?" Well, he said, "That bitch had to be put in jail for not paying child support. Would you come and get me out?" I said, "No, I'm not going to get you out of jail. I suggest you stay in there for a while. And you think about whether you're going to pay child support when you get out of jail." Later on, he got out of jail and he started paying his child support. He hadn't been back in jail since that, isn't that odd?
You know, I never did pay any alimony, ever. You know why? Because when I was drunk, it seemed to me like they would go to the lawyer and get a divorce, file a restraining order on me, and they get the house and the money. Seemed like every time I got a divorce, I had to borrow money from a bank to go get me a lawyer so I could defend myself, because they had all the money. So I didn't have any alimony to pay. They got everything every time. Used to make me so mad.
On page 80, we're not going to try to go through all these. It takes too much time. But on page 80, it talks about where other people were involved. And before this guy made his amends, he decided he needed to go to these other people, get their okay and get their permission before he made the amends, which might end up harming them. On page 81, he talks about sex outside of marriage. What should we do in those kind of situations also? And what we've really found in almost all the cases, when somebody comes to us with a question about making amends, somebody we're sponsoring, we can usually find the answer for it right here in the book. It covers just about any situation that's going to come up. I think what is really, really important here, as we get into steps 8 and 9, I don't really think we know enough about ourselves and about other people to be making the decisions as to when we should or when we should not make amends. I think any amend that we make, we should run it by our sponsors first. They can see the truth about it. We can't. We're involved in it. The sponsor can see it from the outside and see the actual truth about this thing. Some of the amends that I really wanted to make, my sponsor said, "I don't believe y'all do that." He said, "If you make this amend, you're going to hurt that person further yet. And just as importantly, you're going to hurt some other people." He said, "You're just going to have to wait on that one." Others that I said, "I don't believe I owe this person an amends." He said, "Oh yeah, you do. Sit down here and let me explain it to you." And he would show me why I needed to make that amend, and he would tell me how to go about doing it, and then I would go do it. But I really don't think we ought to be doing this on our own. I think this is where we really, really, really need our sponsors. Page 83, third paragraph. There may be some wrongs we can never fully right. You know, some of these people are already dead and buried. Some of them, to make amends to them, would hurt them further, or just as importantly, hurt other people. But we don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would right them if we could. If we can really say that and mean it, then we don't have to worry about that. Some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. There may be a valid reason for postponement in some cases, but we don't delay if it can be avoided. We should be sensible, tactful, considerate, and humble without being servile or scrapy. As God's people, we stand on our feet. We don't crawl before anyone. And one of the great mistakes I see people make in this area, they go to somebody to make an amend, and that person won't accept it. And when that happens to us, it just seems to crush us. And we tend to want to go back and go back and go back and go back and literally beg those people to forgive us. No, we don't have to do that. If they don't want to forgive us, then that becomes their problem. They're sick too. And the only thing we can do with that is to hold ourselves in readiness to make it again at a later date if it becomes possible. You know, I had one, two, or three people tell me, they said, "Charlie, we wasn't very crazy about you when you're drinking. And we really don't care much about you while you're sober. We'd just soon you get the hell out of here and leave us alone." One of those went on for a period of about 27 or 28 years after I got sober. And finally, due to a death in the family, I was able to get with this person, make the amends, and it ended up not hurting anybody at all. But I had to hold off on it for about 27 years. We certainly don't have to go back and crawl and beg, Joe.
Phyllis and I couldn't drink together, I told you that. We finally made a little deal. I said, all right, you take that side of town from here over there, and I'll take this one and this side of town, and I won't bother you and you don't bother me.
Who got the zebra lounge?
Well, I got the zebra lounge. She wouldn't go in the zebra lounge unless she was looking for me. But anyhow, I got that. We had a deal. And there was a little lake on my side of town, about 25 miles up there. And I got me a little mobile home. Nice place. And one night, about 3 o'clock in the morning, the knock on the door, and I finally went to the door, and I kind of, well, she just broke in is what she did. Had her daughter with her, and embarrassed me in front of my girlfriend. Oh, it was awful. After all I'd done for her to treat me like that. And so the next morning I get up and there's all my stuff out in her yard. Y'all know what I mean by stuff, don't you? Dirty t-shirts, dirty shorts, shirts that need, they never throw out anything clean. I don't know why they do. They was all out there in the yard like it's supposed to be. And she ran off with my car. Stole my car.
The daughter couldn't even drive.
But they got my car along with her car back to Tulsa somehow. Went down there and filed for divorce, put a restraining order on me, took all the money out of the bank, and there I was again. Oh, I was mad about that. Well, eventually I get sober, and then 2.5 years later, Phyllis gets sober, and we go back together. 9 years later, I'm standing at the back of the door one night greeting people, and I turned around, and here's the lady of the mobile home incident coming in. Phyllis was at the coffee pot. Some of the guys knew about this deal, and they asked me later, said, what did she say? I said, she didn't say anything for about a week. And then we go to another meeting, and here's this lady again. She was trying to get sober and get her life straightened out. And Phyllis began to talk ugly to me. They'll do that, you know. And another meeting, here's this lady. Finally, after about 2 weeks, Phyllis settled down a little bit so that we could talk about it. And I said, Phyllis, you know, I have already paid I paid emotionally, spiritually, physically, financially, every way I know how. And I told you when we got back together I wouldn't do those things anymore. And you know that I haven't. You know that. And I said, you have a problem with that lady, and I don't. And I suggest you get straight with it. I said, besides that, I'm not paying anymore. It's kind of like last month's electric bill. I paid that one, and I'm not paying no more. They'll let you pay forever and ever and ever and ever if you'll pay. You know what I mean. They will let you pay, and I'm not paying no more. And later on, Phyllis went to lunch with that gal, and they got things straightened up. And she told her, said, look, Alcoholics Anonymous is big enough for two of us, but our group's not big enough for two of us. And that's the way it's been. But they'll let you pay forever and ever and ever.
We don't have to beg them. Okay, now just think. If we got right with God in steps 1, 2, and 3, if we got right with ourselves in steps 4, 5, 6, and 7, if we got right with our fellow man through steps 8 and 9, then that means we are well in all three dimensions of life. And if you're well in all three dimensions of life, you're probably going to feel pretty good. And I don't think it's by accident that the very next thing in the big book are the promises which come at the end of steps 8 and 9. Let's go to page 83 and 84, bottom of page 83, and let's look at these promises for just a few minutes.
And we are painstaking about this phase of our development.
Which phase of our development?
Step 9.
The 8 and 9 phase.
We will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see that our experience can benefit others. The feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we cannot do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises?
We
think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly.
Spiritual experience.
Sometimes slowly.
Spiritual awakening.
They will always materialize if we work for them. One condition, if we work for them, they will always.
You know, when I was new in AA, I come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I was restless, irritable, discontented, full of guilt, shame, and remorse. And I began to apply these principles to my life, the steps. And eventually I began to experience these exact things we're talking, these promises. And I experienced these promises not in my body, but in my mind. I was reborn, not in my body, but in my mind. And these promises are a great example of being a different person.
I'm going to read them again. I read them for two reasons. Number one is I love the way I read them. But number two, hallelujah, whoever said that. Number two is I'm going to add some words to them. They make more sense to me when I read them this way. The words I'm going to add to them refer to a time when I was young, when alcohol was my friend, when I could drink alcohol and become Fred Astaire on the dance floor, and the world's greatest lover in the back seat of a 36 Chevrolet. This is the way alcohol used to make me feel before it turned against me and literally destroyed me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I knew a new freedom and a new happiness. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I did not regret the past or wish to shut the door on it. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would comprehend the word serenity and I would know peace. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, no matter how far down the scale I had gone, I could see how my experience would benefit others. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity would disappear. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, self-seeking would slip away. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, my whole attitude and outlook upon life would change. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, fear of people and economic insecurity would leave me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. Whenever I took a drink of alcohol, I would suddenly realize that alcohol was doing for me what I could not do for myself. Now think about that for a minute. You know, my God, no wonder I love to drink. When you find something that will do that for you, those feelings are so great, you can hardly wait to experience it again, over and over and over and over and over. And for many years, alcohol was my friend. For many years, alcohol did exactly what I wanted it to do. But one day alcohol turned against me. And all the things that I was afraid would happen now begin to happen because of the alcohol. And I became a very, very confused individual. The last several years of my drinking, I spent it trying to recapture these feelings from alcohol. Not knowing I was alcoholic. Not knowing I could never recapture it from alcohol. I damn near destroyed me in the process. And I came to AA and you handed me a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got into that book and one day I began to work this program. And I applied these first 9 steps to my life to the best of my ability. And one day I woke up with these promises in my mind. And I suddenly realized, hey, these first 9 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are doing for me what alcohol used to do for me when it was still my friend. I suddenly realized I've got the same feelings. All the good things that alcohol gave me came also from the first 9 steps. I thought about that for a minute. And then I suddenly realized that so far, the first 9 steps have never turned against me as alcohol did. I've never been placed in jail because of the first 9 steps. Never been drugged through a divorce court because of the first 9 steps. They gave me everything that alcohol used to give me, and they gave me none of the bad things that alcohol gave me. This is the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is why I don't drink. If I hadn't found these promises some way, I would have gone right back to the same thing that always gave it to me when I was young. I would have deluded myself that it would be okay to drink, and I would have gone back and gone back and gone back until I died from alcoholism. The real miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous is the complete change in attitude, the complete change in ideas, emotions, the complete change in outlook upon life, which comes through the working of the first 9 steps. We get here restless, irritable, and discontented. We get here filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. We get here filled with anger and all the stuff that goes with alcoholism. And if we've gone from that stage to the stage of these promises in our minds, then certainly, we've undergone a radical change in our personality. A little design for living in these first 9 steps that really works under all circumstances. Joe, you got anything to add?
No.
Joe, you got anything to add? Well, thank you all for being here. We'll see you later on.
Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. Has John got this thing turned on this morning? I mean, Glenn. Can you hear me okay in the back? Okay. Everything we're going to say is so important, we don't want to miss any of it at all. My name is Charlie Parmin. I'm a very grateful recovering alcoholic because I'm a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the grace of the power that I found through the 12-step program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink for 11,519 days today, one day at a time, and for this I'm very grateful. Happy Mother's Day.
To all your mothers. Yay!
We guys don't always act like it, but we appreciate you mothers. We fully realize if it wasn't for you, we probably wouldn't be here. Of course, we realize we men had a little something to do with it also, but we had the pleasure beside. You all had the work to do. We appreciate you and have a good Mother's Day. Very thankful for you. Joe?
My name is Joe, and I'm an alcoholic.
And Joe.
And it's truly by God's grace and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous I found in a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sober today, and for that I'm very, very thankful. And I've been sober since November 3rd, 1973. And for that, I am thankful. I'd like to read the preamble this morning. Seems like there's not a meeting without a preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and to help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. I'm going to tell you a story. I've been wanting to tell this story all weekend, but I've been afraid to. I mean, you know how my stories are. They're not very good. But this one I've been thinking hard about. And this is Midget Logger. This little midget logger, he went up into the North Country, up in the woods, and he wanted to get a job as a logger. So he went into the woods and asked this fellow, said, "Where's the logging boss?" And he said, "Well, there's a Swede over there. He's about 6'7". You can't hardly miss him." So he went over to that Swede and pulled on his britches leg. He looked down and said, "What do you want, little fella?" He said, "Well, I want a job." He said, "I want a job as a logger." He said, "We don't hire midgets here." He said, "I didn't come here to get a job as a midget. I come here to get a job as a logger. And I'm a good one, too." He said, "Oh, I don't think you are." He said, "Take that axle and jump on that bull pine over there," which was about 6 foot on the stump. And he went over there, and, man, the chips just flew. The Swede went over and said, "Man, I've been in the woods all of my dang life, and I've never seen anybody handle an axe the way you do. Where'd you learn to handle an axe like that?" And he said, "Well, when I was a little fella, my daddy took me out of that Mojave forest, and we cut wood from sun up to sundown, day in, day out, year in, year out. And when you do anything like that, you get good at it." He said, "Wait a minute, little fella." He said, "I thought the Mojave was a desert." He said, "Well, it is now."
I think you did a little better with that one, don't you?
Yeah. I had to think long and hard to come up with a good one.
We've talked a lot over the weekend about alcoholism and the history of AA and how long alcoholism has been around and so on and so forth. I've got a little thing I want to read to you this morning to indicate maybe how long it's been here in the States. And this is a little story about the USS Constitution. It said, on August the 23rd, 1779, the USS Constitution set sail from Boston with 475 officers and men on board. She had 48,600 gallons of fresh water, 7,400 cannon shot, 11,600 pounds of black powder, and 79,000 gallons of rum. She had permission to harass and destroy English shipping. Making Jamaica on October the 6th, she took on 825 pounds of flour and 68,300 gallons of rum. Then she headed for the Azores, where she arrived on November the 12th. She provisioned with 550 pounds of beef and 54,300 gallons of Portuguese wine. On November the 18th, she set sail for England. In the ensuing days, she defeated 5 British men of war, captured and scuttled 15 English merchantmen, salvaging only the rum. By January 27th, her powder and shot were exhausted. Unarmed, she made a night raid up the Firth of Clyde, and her landing party captured a whiskey distillery and transferred 40,000 gallons of whiskey aboard before dawn. Then she headed for home. USS Constitution arrived in Boston Harbor in February 1780 with no cannon shot, no food, no powder, no rum, no whiskey, no wine, and 48,600 gallons of stagnant water. Been around a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah.
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic.
Hi, Joe.
Through God's grace, the College of this program works. I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since the 10th of March, 1962. It's good to be here this morning for a final. Everybody's telling this story. I had one of my favorites I heard lately. I got accused of telling a new one. Well, this is about a couple that went to the doctor, and the fellow walked in and told the doctor, said, "Doctor, I would just like to... I know it's a strange request, but I'd like you to watch us have sex and see if it's all right." He said, "I never had a request like that, but I guess it's all right." So they went in and they had sex, and he watched. He said, "Hey, y'all did all right." And he said, okay, and they left, and they come back the next Wednesday. And said, doctor, I'd like for you to have us watch us have sex again. He said, what is this? This is strange. Why are y'all showing up here for that? He said, well, doctor, he said, we can't go to her house. You see, she's married. And we can't go to my house because I'm married. So the Holiday Inn wants almost $100. And say, you just charged $25 a visit. He said, Medicare pays $20 of that. And AARP pays $4.50. And don't cost us for 50 cents to come here.
Oh, we're getting spiritualist born, aren't we? Huh? All right. We finished up our session yesterday with the promises. And as we talked about those promises, we said, of course, that they all were in the mind, nothing to do with the body at all. And if we had received all those promises in our minds, then surely we had undergone a great change in our personality. We came here restless, irritable, discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And if we've gone from that state of mind to the state of mind that's in the promises itself, then surely we have undergone a great change in our personality. Probably we have undergone a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening, because that's what spiritual experience or spiritual awakening is defined as, the personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism. So if that's true, then why do we need the last three steps? A lot of people in AA will tell us that the last three steps are maintenance steps to maintain our sobriety. And we don't really believe that's true. You see, the word maintenance itself is a misnomer. In order to maintain something, that means you keep it as is. Another natural law applies here that says nothing in our universe ever stays as is. Everything in our universe is in a constant state of change. It's either growing or it's dying, it's progressing, it's regressing. Nothing ever remains the same. So if we tried just to maintain what we had received at the end of step 9 through the promises, then sure enough we would begin to slip back. And next thing you know, we start having trouble with people. Next thing you know, we start having trouble with ourselves. Next thing you know, we're blocked off from God. The next thing you know, we end up drunk all over again. Now, we've made a tremendous amount of growth through these first 9 steps. But if we try to remain exactly there, maintain that particular status, then sooner or later we're going to get into trouble. You know, twice in the big book, once in Bill's story, once in chapter 2, he talks about a fourth dimension of existence that we never even dreamed of, period. Far, far beyond the normal three. The normal three, we got well in those three through the first 9 steps. But there's another existence, a fourth dimension, that if we can get on into it, then we become absolutely free of practically all these things that have bothered us all of our life. And we like to look at the last three steps, 10, 11, and 12, not just as maintenance steps. We'll agree that they'll help us stay sober. But we really like to look at them as growth steps intended to continue our spiritual growth, intended to continue our relationship with God and our fellow man, not only continue them but improve on them, until we move into an entirely new dimension of living. So this morning we'd like to, for just a few minutes, take a little look at 10, 11, and 12, see if we can't see the actual growth factor in those three steps. Joe?
This page 84. This thought brings us to step 10. We suggest we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we clean up the past. We have entered the world of spirit.
We've had a spiritual experience or a spiritual awakening already.
Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness.
Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness, not remain where we are, not maintain, but to actually grow in understanding and effectiveness.
This is not an overnight matter. It should continue for a lifetime. Continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear.
What step did we use to look at that in the first place? Anybody remember?
Step four.
Okay.
Yeah. So it means to continue step four. When they crop up, we ask God to remove them.
What steps did we use for that?
Six and seven.
Six and seven, okay.
And continue to use six and seven. We discuss them with someone immediately.
What step was that?
Step five.
We continue step five. And make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone.
And what steps did we use there?
Eight and nine.
Steps eight and nine, okay.
So according to the book, step 10 is a continuous practice of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 on a daily basis. Now, if you were to continue to use those, you would not remain the same. You would improve. You would have to grow.
The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous appeared to the world for the first time in the big book Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939. Now, sometime after that, AA made a bad mistake. They took the steps out of the book. They put them on little wallet cards that we carry in our wallets and our purses. They put them on wall charts and hung them up on the wall. Now, taking the steps out of the book and hanging them on the wall and putting them on the wallet cards was not the mistake. The mistake was that when they took the steps out of the book and put them on the wall charts and the wallet cards, they left the directions on how to work them in the book. And people come to an AA meeting, they see the steps up on the wall, they read them, they interpret what they mean in their minds, and they try to work the steps accordingly. And we're going to find there's a big difference in the interpretation of step 10, especially from the wall chart to the big book itself. You read step 10 off the wall chart, it says continue to take personal inventory, and we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Now, it looks like the only thing we have to do to fulfill the intent of step 10 from the wall chart is continue to take inventory. When we're wrong, promptly admit it, and we will have completed step 10. Somewhere we got the idea that you don't even need to do that till you go to bed at night. Now, Joe and I, we both agree we have reached the age where we don't get in trouble in bed much anymore.
That's Charlie and Joe.
This Joe is younger. I think he's still having a little difficulty with that once in a while, but Joe and I don't have any problem. Our problem is during the daytime.
Walking around, dangerous.
We don't need any going... We don't need any going to bed kind of deal there. We need a walking around step for us. I've got that little inventory sheet right up here in my forehead, and I can see it just plain as day, and you guys can too. What I have finally learned to do is if I get screwed up, say, at 10 o'clock in the morning, it really doesn't make any sense to stay screwed up all day long, waste another day in resentments and etc., and wait till I go to bed at night to do something about it. Besides that, if I get screwed up at 10 o'clock in the morning and I don't do something about it right then, by nighttime I'm an absolute basket case. I've cussed two or three people out, and two or three's cussed me out, and we're in a hell of a shape by nighttime. What I finally learned to do is if I get screwed up about 10 o'clock, is to stop whatever I'm doing, get off in the corner by myself and say, okay, Charlie, who are you mad at? What did they do to you? Which part of self is affected? What did you do, if anything, to set this in motion? Which character defect has come back to the surface? Always selfishness, dishonesty, self-seeking, frightened, or inconsiderate, one of those character defects has come back. I can spot it immediately. I can say, okay, God, you know I don't want to be this way. Please take this selfishness away from me, or this dishonesty, or whatever it might be. Discuss it with someone immediately, as soon as I can, preferably my sponsor, and then make amends quickly if I've harmed anyone. And just a matter of a few minutes, that whole deal is gone. The rest of the day is peaceful and happy and free. I would defy anybody in this room to work step 10 the way the big book says to work it and stay the way you are. You absolutely cannot do that. As we continue to take personal inventory, we learn more about ourselves. As we discuss these things with someone else, we learn more about ourselves. As we ask God to remove these things, they become less and less. As we make amends quickly to people we've harmed, our relationship with the world and everybody in it becomes better and better and better and better and better. There's no way that we can work step 10 the way the big book says to work it and stay the way we are. Once in a great while, though, I don't want to do that. There are times that I kind of like to be screwed up. There's times I like to be mad. There's times I like to be afraid, because I can use that to rationalize and justify saying and doing things I shouldn't be saying and doing, at the same token saying and doing and not doing things that I ought to be doing. Today I realize when I'm that way, it gives me a comfortable feeling of superiority. But I don't enjoy it like I used to. Somewhere about the middle of it, I catch myself and say, okay, idiot, you're doing it to yourself again. It is your responsibility to determine whether you're going to be screwed up or whether you're not going to be screwed up. Step 10 is an actual growth step.
You know, and the book goes on to say that love and tolerance of others is our code. You know we had a code, didn't you? Love and tolerance of others is our code. And then we get some more promises as a result of practicing 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 over and over and over. And it says, and we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time sanity will have returned. Remember we said real early Thursday that the problem is that we are powerless over alcohol, and that our lives have become unmanageable. The solution was that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Well, we get our sanity back on page 84 as a result of 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. He said, for by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally and find this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor had been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. See, we refined the power, and the power would solve the problem. It just comes without any thought or effort on our part. That's a miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We've not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. We're neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react, so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition. And again, back on page 45, it said the main object of this book which enabled me to find a power greater than myself which would solve my problem. And beginning there from page 59, we had the third step, steps 3 through 9. We worked the steps. And as a result of that, we get our sanity back. And this desire to drink, the obsession to drink, has been removed. And I'll never forget when that happened for me. As I said years ago, prior to AA, when I had those enforced times of sobriety, I'd just be thumbing through a magazine, and I'd see a bottle of whiskey with the water running down the side and make me so thirsty my mouth would water. Had a great obsession to drink. That hasn't happened. One day I looked up and it was just gone. Never to seriously have been tempted since that time. That's the miracle of it. That's what happens in Alcoholics Anonymous.
I think it's real simple. Sean said when we have a problem, haven't taken the step, we've been given some tools through 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 to eliminate problems in our lives. And we shouldn't be told that how to reuse these things. We all want to reuse these things every day. And when a problem comes up, when I feel uncomfortable, something uncomfortable in my life, I know there's something wrong with me. And if there's something wrong with me, I have tools to work on. If it's somebody, if I can lay it off on somebody else, I'm in trouble. Because I ain't got no tools to work on them. But my main rule, personal rule, is it's my fault. Thank God it's my fault. Because I can fix me. I have some tools to work on me. So if I'm uncomfortable, I want to be. And I, as Charlie said, we can run through. The more you practice. It takes practice. The more you practice, the better you can. You can spot it real quick. What's your basic instinct has been? I don't have to do the first two columns. I have to do what's wrong with me. What's being hurt? And I can spot it right away. And then I can say, which defect have you got? And I can spot that right away. And I can take care of that and have a good day. You know, I like to go around and watch people. I love people today. I'm very interested in people. All kinds of people, not just alcoholics. And I like to go in grocery stores and work my step 10 in the checkout line. And watch them fool-ass people run from line to line. They'll be running from line to line. Ain't gonna do nothing, ain't going nowhere. And they get all upset and mess their lives all up. And I like standing there and reading them stupid books, you know. And you know, when you get outside, all them is out there in the car at the same time. And, but it's great, you know, and we can live better than most people, but we have to work at it. It's not a gift. It's not a gift. Step 10 is the greatest growth step of my life. Most of my growth has come through step 10 on a daily basis. And it can put us in a dimension of living that other people can't be as happy as we are. They don't sleep as well as we can. Because they don't, thank God, I feel sorry for them, they don't have the tools that we have to live with. But it's all up to how we use them and apply them.
You got to be real careful with step 10. Because it's just like step 6 and 7. Now that we know how to use step 10 the way the book says to do it, if we get screwed up in our lives and stay that way, then that must mean that that's the way we want to be. You see, we don't have to be that way any longer. If I get mad in the morning and I want to get rid of it, I've got the tools to do it. If I get afraid in the afternoon and I don't want to be that way, I've got the tools to do that. And as I continue practicing these things over and over and over and over, then I continually get better as far as my personality change is concerned. So if I'm screwed up today, I've got to have the full realization that I am responsible for the way that I think, for the way I feel, for the way I act, and the way I react. I don't have to do those things any longer if I don't wish to. And slowly through, especially 6, 7, and then practicing it over and over and over through step 10, my relationship with God, myself, my fellow man continues to change. An actual growth factor. Page 85. First paragraph.
It says, you know, it's easy to let up on the spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. We're headed for trouble if we do, for alcohol is a subtle foe. We're not cured of alcoholism. What we really have is a daily reprieve contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition, one day at a time. See, it's real easy to let up on this spiritual program of action and rest on our laurels. Excuse me. You can only coast downhill. And if you get, by the time you get to here, if you were like me, things are real good in my house. I'm back home, sleeping on the couch. If you're really lucky, you're back in the bedroom.
Might be.
Yeah, it might be. And by this time, the dogs quit biting you. You got a couple of televisions and a car. Kids are speaking to you. Things are good. Getting a steady paycheck. If you're not careful, things will start competing for your sobriety. We get too busy to ask for help. We get too busy to go to meetings. We get too busy to help other people. And we start to coast back. things can compete for your sobriety, and they will get your sobriety. I had a friend of mine just recently when I first got here. He was 29 years sober. Heard that he got drunk. Called him. He lives over in Arkansas. I said, Kermit, what happened? He's a typical thing. Been sober 29 years. I got so busy in my work that I didn't have time to go to meetings. I quit asking for help. Too busy. Quit helping others. Got too busy. And one day, I woke up and it seemed like the most natural thing to do to take a drink. He didn't even vaguely sense that he was doing anything wrong the way he explained it to me. It just seemed like the most natural thing to do. And that's what happened. And that's what happens in AA a lot of times. Things compete for your sobriety, and things will get your sobriety if you're not careful. And it says here that every day is a day when we must carry the vision of God's will into all of our activities. How can I best serve thee? Thy will, not mine, be done. These are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. All this weekend we've been talking about willpower and how it's no good, not good for us. We got lots of willpower. You see, but here on page 84 you get your sanity back. Page 85 you get your willpower back. And wouldn't it be awful if you had your willpower but you didn't have any sanity to know how to operate with it? God never gave us anything that was bad. Everything he ever gave us was good. Our willpower is good too, properly used. He said, these are thoughts which must go with us constantly. We can exercise our willpower along this line all we wish. It's the proper use of the will. Thy will, not mine, be done. That's the proper use of the will. This next paragraph is one of my favorite in the books. Charlie?
The book says, much has already been said about receiving strength, inspiration, and direction, not suggestion, and direction from him who has all knowledge and power. If we've carefully followed directions, not suggestions, if we've carefully followed directions, we have begun to sense the flow of his spirit into us. To some extent, we've become God conscious. We've begun to develop this vital sixth sense, but we must go further, and that means more action. Now, we're referring here to a God consciousness. We're referring to it as a vital sixth sense. You know, everything I know on a conscious level, I've learned through five senses of direction. I can see, I can smell, I can taste, I can hear, and I can touch. Those are the normal five senses of direction. And we human beings, as we grow up, everything that we learn through those five senses of direction. Now you can take everything that I know that I've learned through my five senses of direction, and you can take everything that these two Joes know, and you can take everything that everybody in this room knows, and you can take everything that every human being on earth knows and add it all together. And it's just a tiny, tiny, tiny speck of information related to the knowledge of the universe. Now, if God has all power, and I'm convinced he does, my book says so. If God has all knowledge, and I'm convinced he does, and if God dwells within each of us, and I'm convinced that he does, the book says he does, that means you and I have within ourselves all the knowledge and all the power that we could ever need to handle any conceivable situation that might come up in the future, provided we know how to tap into that knowledge and that power. That sixth sense of direction that lies within each of us. It's long been known that the way you tap into that knowledge and that power is through prayer and meditation. Most of us, when we get here, we're completely bankrupt in those areas. I knew nothing at all about meditation. Oh, I'd heard that one way to meditate was sit down and listen to soft music. I heard another way was to clear your mind of all thought. I don't know about you guys, but I know about me. I've never been able to clear my mind of all thought. When I get up in the morning, that sucker turns on and it runs all day long. I've never been able to stop it. I'd heard about meditation where you chant certain words over and over and over again. I knew nothing about those things. I knew nothing about meditation, period. And even being raised in church, when I got here, I knew very little about prayer. The only thing I knew about prayer, I only had two of them anyhow when I got here. One went like this. It said, "Now lay me down to sleep. I pray the Lord my soul to keep. And if I die," but I'm not into that one anymore. That's dealing with death, and I'm not too interested in that. The other one I used, and I'm quite sure some of you probably used it too, went like this: "God, if you get me out of this damn mess, I swear I'll never do this again." Now that was the extent of my knowledge when it comes to prayer and meditation when I came to AA. And now then, my book is saying to me, I'm going to have to develop this sixth sense of direction. I'm going to have to develop it through prayer and meditation. And it would seem to be almost an impossible task for people like me to be able to do that. Thank God Bill Wilson was a real alcoholic. Thank God Bill Wilson felt just exactly the way I felt when I got to AA. Thank God he knew the trouble I was going to have. Because on the next couple of pages, with just a few simple suggestions, he taught me how to pray and he taught me how to meditate so I could receive God's power and God's will in my life and develop this sixth sense of direction. And the longer I do it, the more I practice it, the better it becomes. Step 11 says we sought through prayer and meditation to improve, not maintain, to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him. Joe?
Before we do that, Glenn, you want to flip the